Mr. T.G. Rogers, who tells me you're 78.
78?
And he certainly doesn't look it. And he joined up in August 1914 at the age of 17, and he's now going to tell us about his First World War experiences.
I was born at Frodsham in Cheshire, 19th of September, 1896. My father was a water engineer and looked after all the pumping systems for the district. And there were eight of us in the family, four boys and four girls. We lived in a side lane off the main Chester, Warrington or Chester, Manchester Road. And this side lane was the surface was made of cinders or ash from the stations and rolled down, so that if you looked along our lane you would see on the ground all sorts of things that kiddies use for hopscotch and marbles and I don't know what, you see. And really, they were really happy times. We had to make our own games, of course. Eight in our family and most big families round about, and the mothers had no time for pussiness, you see, and so it was a case of out you go, it's washing day, get out, you see, and that sort of thing. And it was making us find our own amusement in that way, and believe me, we did. Because of Frodsham, there are the hills on the south side. A vast expanse of Cheshire Plain is the marshes and the River Weaver and the Mersey, where the Weaver runs into the Mersey, you see. They were our happy hunting grounds, and we did a lot of work there, you see.
When, excuse me, when you say a lot of work, do you mean you got up to no good, or...?
Well, I shall put it this way, that we hear a lot about children these days being very naughty. Well, they are. Some are beyond a little bit beyond the pale, but we were not angels by any means. The difference is that if I put my nose to a shop window, you see, and flatten my nose on it, then the outraged owner would come outside and say, "Hop it," you see. And if I didn't, then the policeman would come along with his cape, wrap it round my face, you see, and that's it, and off we'd go. That was it, the punishment there and then, and we went on. But there were such nice things going on, you know. All these games, the kiddies, we were playing Boars and English, I suppose you played that yourself, Fox and Hounds, all these things, as hide and try to find, you see. During the Saturday afternoon, for instance, we would be playing in the lane and we'd see, probably a quarter of a mile away, old William come along. And old William had two baskets, two heavy baskets, on one on each arm. And these baskets would be filled with buttons and elastic and bric-a-brac that all the ladies wanted to see. But it wasn't a case of going to a superstore or anything of that, you see. They used to take them round to the housewives and that sort of thing. Well, this William that I talk about now, he was a local preacher and a Sunday school teacher. And we kids used to run along to meet him like mad, you see. Take a basket off his arm, two lads take the other basket, and then the girls would have hold his hand, you see, and he would sway back and forth because he was getting old and a big beard. He used to say that Robin's built in his beard, you see, but of course I don't believe that myself. Anyhow, he came along, and it was our job, this is important, it was our job to get him to response to what we were saying, and this had been built up over years. And as the older boys boys and girls in the group got older, because they left, and of course there's others coming up and they're joined, sort of thing. And it went something like this. I can't get it just accurately, I don't suppose, but I'll try. It started, "Tell us, William, tell us a story." And he would say, "Christ in his glory. Tell us another. Be good to your mother. Tell us another. Be kind to your brother." And this sort of thing went on, and I forget the in-betweens, but I think the last one was, "And what shall we say? Our Father, night and day." And that was all it. And we were bringing this quarter mile to where the houses start again, you see, with these baskets. And he would go in, and then, of course, somebody had given a, probably a bowl of soup or a cup of tea or something like that, you see. But he would give us a hard-boiled sweet, and that was a marvellous prize for us. I wonder now, you see, because I'm very fond of kiddies myself, I daren't stop to talk to a child. Children are taught not to speak to strangers and that sort of thing. There is a big difference. The happiness gone out of the lane, you see. And that's how things have gone. And then, of course, there were the older boys and young men who used to play gambling, ballet, what do you call it, motty or something, a piece of mug in a ring by a wall, and used to throw a ball at him and knock it out if they could, and so on, for winnings of some sort. Then, of course, the people themselves, the women, when they wanted their children back home, you see, and they're probably a mile down the marshes. One woman could make her voice heard that mile, right across the marshes. And it was said that she did her best when the police were coming down, because the young men were playing cards somewhere down the marsh, you see, and that type of thing.
She was sort of warning the young men, yes, that the police were coming, in other words.
Yes, yeah. When she made a call, it was it was that. And then, of course, there was the old man, old Darkey. I won't put his name. Old Darkey. He lived outside, and in barns and stacks. And he lived on what he got out of the fields, and what he could pinch from the farms, a hen that was running astray or something like that. And in summer, peewit's eggs, and weeds in the water, rushes. Now, if you take the centre of a rush out, have you ever done that?
No.
You've not? Well, it's very, very tender. It's lovely to eat. I've done thousands of them. Just dry. Don't snatch. Pull gently, and the centre will come out, and you eat it right away. Clean and not been touched by air till now. And they used to do that sort of thing, you see. And I know we did we offered this man sixpence. This is a crowd of us kids, you see. Could you get eightpence, you see? Could you get eightpence? And so on. And we made it to sixpence. And he would take us where he went, and he did. He showed us where he lived, and some old brambles, well sheltered, and cardboard and old rags to live in. And he showed us how he caught snigs. You know what a snig is? It's an eel, and it's under the bank. And he showed us how to catch eels, you know. And also he took us this. See rabbits running in the spot he knew, you see, in a copse, and we had to be there at a certain time, and he took us just before the sunset, you see, because he said the young ones came out at that time, but the old ones didn't, unless there was something to warn them about. And of course, if the old ones came out and thumped their back feet on the ground, the young ones went rushing in, went rushing home. You see, that's That just happens now. It's just, well, Paul Bexham told us it is. But all that sort of life, you see, it was our hunting ground, our way of life, you see, as youngster. Then on the hills, we go on the hills, and on Trodgen Hill there is a chair cut in rock, solid rock. They call it the devil's armchair. And what most wishing chairs, or wishing wells, or anything at all else, want you to wish for what you want. Well, apparently, whatever you wished in this chair didn't come. It went opposite to what you wanted it to do, you see. It was always a lot of fun, that thing. The last time I saw it was a great pity. It was overgrown, but of course the chair itself wasn't. It's just cut in the rock, and it's bound to be there, still there, on Jacob's Ladder, which is steps down. All those are our hunting grounds. Now, on the main road, of course, the surfaces were macadam, mixed up with water and some fine stuff, you see. Spread on and then rolled down with the steam engine, steam roller. Well, it was all very well, and of course we'd watch that. But during dry weather, then of course they had to get out the watering carts, because when there was a wind, it took clouds of dust everywhere. You don't see it now, but it did then. And of course the watering carts used to be out, and we kids used to be following this watering cart. Great stuff, you know. A scream from the girls if they got a spot on them, and the lad would troll, you know, we'll do it. Oh yes. And also in Trudgeon there's a steep part, they call it the rock. And when the coach and horses used to come along, probably from Chester Races, for instance, they had to walk up the rock, it was too steep to run. And so when they were going up, we kids used to get on the side, out with it, mister, out with it, mister. And they'd throw their halfpennies down, suppose the winners did. And so on and so on. And that was a grand time, well, that was 2 or 3 times a year. And of course, excursions used to go to the hills and all that sort of thing. Well, here again, we...
This would be all horse-drawn.
Oh, yes, no. Nothing about a long time. Mm. Well, now, in my home, there was... how shall I describe my mother? I have described her this way, that she would have a Bible in one hand and a flaming sword in the other, that she would make us go to church, you see, go to chapel and Sunday school and that. And my earliest recollections of going to Sunday school was a great stiff collie and all that wide up here, full of potatoes, feeling all hot and bothered and going to Sunday school. I didn't like that at all. It was too warm. But nevertheless, that was it. And then, of course, around the kitchen, we lived in an old pub, 16th century old pub, you see. It wasn't above then, of course, then, you know, but the cellars were there. And my father was keeping the pub somewhere else, so it was a job to keep two going that way. Round the walls were pictures of royalty. My mother, very loyal, they seemed to be the clan, and prided ourselves. Well, when I got a bit older, I joined the Boy Scouts, and I loved every minute of it. My mother used to give me threepence, and I would buy 3 pennyworth, which is Dickens of a lot, of fig biscuits in those days, and I would go with Trodgen Scouts, pulling a handcart up the steep hills to Delamere Forest, and probably camp there for the night, you see, like the next day. I must have had something else besides those 3 pennies worth of pig biscuits, but it was a glorious, glorious time. And especially when we did get older, one time, another part of the forest was another group of scouts, you see. And we said we would attack them and get in inside their camp. And we did, you see. Oh, that's marvellous. We thought of that, you see. Well, that was a case of looking after ourselves, seeing to fires and doing everything orderly and that sort of thing. And that really was a good thing for me. Because when war broke out, I felt I'd got to go. I had 2 brothers older than me, and I went off without saying a word to anybody. This was August. I would have been 18 the following month, September. And I got a shilling, which was quite a lot in those days, and I wrote a letter to my mother to say that, well, that's it, they come to need me, and here I am. But then I got on the coarse side of life, because at Chester Castle, a lot of the reservists, old soldiers, had been called in, and they were just, to me, they were terrible people, you see. And I say, that is when I joined the coarser side of life. Well now, from that time, the 8th Battalion Cheshire Regiment was the Kitchener's Army 1st Battalion, you see, of the Cheshire Regiment. And we went to Salisbury Plain, and probably being a bit slick, they made me a machine gunner, so I joined the gunners, and to cut a long story short, we went out to Gallipoli.
Just could I stop you here, Mr. Rogers,
yes,
and get back to your feeling when you were talking about the coarser side of life? Now, you suddenly found yourself shoved in with a load of regular soldiers and so on. Now, this must have been a terrific change in your way of life. Did it take you long to adjust yourself to it, or did it soon?
Well, I adjust myself to it is probably the right way to say it. I couldn't join it. I'd been brought up as a churchman and a Sunday school man, a bit of an imp, of course, at that. But nevertheless, it's in the same sort of thing
of
women
and
boozing and all that sort of thing that didn't come to my standards at all. But there again, I just had to accept it.
Yeah.
And I'd taken the step, and that was it. Now, the other point is that ever since I've been a child, I've only got one good eye. And I can't read with the other eye, but I can see light, I can see outlines of things, and it doesn't trouble me a bit. And in those days, my doctor said it was a lazy eye. I say in those days, because my doctor these days says, well, there's no such thing as a lazy eye. However, never mind that. I passed the examination by opening the fingers, you see, and just looking through. Oh, it's easy. So I joined up with one
eye. You cheated a bit,
yeah. Oh, help myself. I wanted to do something, and I did it.
Self-sufficiency.
That's why I did it. Yeah. And I was a gunner, and by the way, this one good eye is a good eye, because I've been a marksman for most of my life, and shooting after the war, a big lot of it. But I say, we went to Gallipoli on the ship Mudros, I think, right? And we machine gunners were put on the stern of the ship, and we had to look out for U-boats. Then, goodness knows what had happened if one had appeared.
Now, this troop
couldn't have done anything at all.
This troop ship must have been pretty crowded.
Yes, it was.
And living conditions obviously were certainly less than you'd been used to.
Did you find that this got on your nerves? Did tempers get frayed as you got nearer and nearer the Mediterranean, where it got hotter and hotter?
No, because it was in the earlier part of the year, wasn't it? February or March?
Yes.
I don't know. Anyhow, in any case, I was posted on the back, you see, on the outside in the stern, you see. But I'd also been in the camp at Salisbury Plain with all these brush-ups, you know, from the old army game. And our company commander was a religious man. He used to hold services on board ship, which I didn't fall in with very well, because I thought, well, if we're going to war, that'd be different. Why should we? Who's going to beat us up, you see? Wouldn't they be praying? And we went on this boat to Mudus Island. That's why I'm getting confused there. To Mudus Island, a Greek island. And from there, after about 48 hours, we went by destroyer to Gallipoli. There we found the river.
Hello.
The River Clyde, wasn't it? The ship that was took the first batch there. That was run ashore, and we a sort of staging built alongside it on the sheltered side. And we had this embarked there and went inland on the peninsula. Right away I can say that we were not trained for what we met. We were not trained for the conditions. We were given clothing, a helmet, and I don't know what, you see. But as far as I remember, we had not dug a trench. We were put into the trenches there. We'd not dug a trench. It was getting hot now, and we not being used to the temperature, well, we were very thirsty. And what happened was they dug holes into the ground, I suppose somebody started it, and the water seeped into the holes, into the sumps, you see, and we was pulling the water out. But in no time at all, the round hole was seething with black flies. And in no time at all, a lot of the boys started the dysentery. Fortunately, I remained healthy and I was able to help quite a lot of people. And all my scouting tricks I found came in useful there, you see. And now, we were posted as a machine gun position with our battalion. And then we were transferred round to the other side. I forget what we call it now, some gully round the other side of the peninsula. And there we were posted with the Australians. We were supporting an attack. When I think of this attack, I think of it being silly. Because there's a little obstruction, there's little or no barbed wire that I could see there. And the Australians had to attack there. Our job was to fire this machine gun into the support, into the communication trench, from the rear to the front, you see. Shoot into that if we could, you see. And that was our job. Well, 0 hour came, our warships were bombarding the Turk line, but it wasn't good enough. And in no time at all, when the Australians attacked, they were just mown down, and that was it. We were firing into the communication trench as ordered, and we were doing that very well until a sniper put a bullet right through the backside, centre through that backside, clear hole through it. And the officer was firing the gun, and I was his number two on the side, you see. And I was splattered with metal, I suppose, because I had a bloody face afterwards. And he wasn't hurt at all. But no time at all, due to training, you see, we slipped another sight in and continued to fire where I could see it was hopeless. And that was our first, my first engagement.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how did you feel? Up until now, you've never seen bloodshed, presumably, or even sort of been under fire. What were your feelings about this?
Or rather numb, sort of doing something that we had to do. The Australians were not people I knew. There was one little incident that affected me a little bit, in that the major, we call him the major, who was the liaison officer with us, and he was leading the attack. And, well, as he got to the top of the trench, he was hit off the top of his own trench, and he just fell down. He said, "I saw it." And I warned the Australians that he was just over, and they dug for him and got him in. Now, but we were not in close touch with him at all. With just that job to do.
Did you feel fear at all?
I don't think I did. Now, here you're coming up to fear. It's a difficult thing to describe. If I was to say fear, not on this occasion, I would say, but if I'm going to describe fear, it's something totally different from what we know as. Fear usually is shock, isn't it? Apprehension is probably a gentle arm. Yes, I would say no. I sort of took it as it came. By the way, I'm not an excitable person, I'm told. But I maintain that I'm not an excitable person after being in France. I'm not before. So in this case, it didn't happen. Yeah. So. Well, we were put into another position up this gully, in the defensive position. And I was at the gun, number one, this day, and I saw, we had to look up a bit, and saw the Turkish trench altering form. Now, I think it was my country bringing up, you see, my country breeding, that I noticed the different alteration in the skyline. Then I told that officer about it, and he didn't think so at first, but later on he was convinced. That it was, and he told me to get the gun onto it and that the camouflage off, which I did. And we could see sandbags on the inner side, on their side of it. So it was a defence work, or a spy work they were putting up. Having done that and revealed it, then we handed it over, our officer handed it over to the Indian Mountain Batteries, and they demolished it very quickly, see. Well, I was, cock-a-hoop about this. I thought, well, you see, my good turn for the day sort of thing. Well, it was very short-lived, because no sooner had I done that than a Turkish shell landed right under my gun and blew me up. And I was unconscious. I don't remember anything except waking up on an ambulance ship.
Are you Red Cross.
Well, it was my eyes chiefly, my good eye really, and they said there was like a pepper pot, so I'd missed a good bang, you see, and I'd got all the bits and pieces from everywhere, and I was blinded for a time.
What were your feelings then? At that time, presumably, you couldn't see, and it must have worried you. You might have been permanently blind. How did you feel?
That did worry me. Yes, I did feel awful. But here again, everything was so nice about me. The nurses were so nice. The orderlies, the men orderlies, were nice, you see, and would come and say a few words, but go off very quickly when I inquired about myself, you see. And of course, It is as it should be. I didn't get an answer until the doctor came round, who said that I'd been knocked about a bit, that he couldn't see any damage outside the eye, except for the bits and pieces all over the place. And I'd have to go out of the bright sunshine and get back to England for treatment. And briefly, that is what happened.
Tell me, earlier on you mentioned about the flies. Now, of the reading that I've done concerning the Gallipoli campaign, this does seem to be a constant worry of people that were there. Can you tell me something about the conditions that you were subjected to, these flies? Every time you ate, I understand, you had to brush virtually a black carpet of flies off your food and this sort of thing.
Well,
is this true, or would that be any...
No, I don't think that is true. You don't leave food there to be...
Yeah.
You cover it up and you eat it, sort of thing. No, but it was true of the waterholes. It was true of that. But see, if you've got flies in any case, the odd one or two, it's bad enough. And they spread the disease. And it was dysentery, which was very, very distressing. As I say, I kept all right. The Indians were on there, and they seemed to be all right, as far as they used to it.
Yes.